One. I'm Charles Woolforth here for another Coffee House Conversation. Did you know that University of Alaska Anchorage has a team which is number 9 in the world? There's only one American university that is better than us in this team activity. And it's been that way for years. I mean, we've been really, really good for a long time. I'm not obviously talking about hockey or basketball. I'm talking about debate. UAA's debate team is world-ranked number 9. There's only one U.S. university that's better than UAA, and that's Yale. And so that means we easily beat podunk colleges like Harvard and, you know, Stanford and so forth. And the guy who makes that happen as coach is with me today. Steve Johnson is the director of debate at UAA. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
You've had many years of success, but this last year has been kind of a milestone in terms of what you've accomplished. I mean, it's really, you obviously are getting attention nationally and worldwide for the success of this team.
The last 2 years have been outstanding years for us, but they are built on a solid tradition of some pretty outstanding students who've gone and accomplished some amazing things in competitive debate.
Yeah. Well, you went to the Philippines, and this was your opportunity to compete with basically every university in the world with a good debating team.
Right.
And did you come in there? I mean, tell me what the scene is like.
Sure.
I mean, 500 universities, that's extraordinary.
Well, not 500 universities, it's about 250 universities. Mm-hmm. And they make up about 400 debating teams. A team is a two-person student team. And the teams, of course, are formed into squads. So there are about 250 squads from 250 different universities, mm-hmm. From about 45 nations from every inhabited continent on the earth. And this is the World University's Debating Championships. It's held once a year. It's the largest competitive student gathering outside of the Student World Games, which is an athletic contest that's held every couple of years. But it's an amazing gathering of students who get together to argue some of the most compelling policy issues and financial issues and moral issues of our day. And it is populated by literally the best student debaters from the best universities around the world, the Oxfords, the Cambridges, the Australians, who are outstanding debaters, Monash University of Sydney, Australian National University, and very well represented by US and North American universities as well.
So is it like everybody in one big conference hotel or something? Set the scene
for us. Yeah, there's about 1,400 people between the adjudicators and the debaters. We're there together for about 10 days. There are 3 days of preliminary rounds in which all teams compete. There are 9 preliminary rounds in which all teams compete. And so those teams begin with a random matching in the first round, and then each successive round is power match. So the good teams with winning records go up against other good teams with winning records. And eventually through that process, the best teams are sorted and keep climbing.
Like a tournament bracket.
Exactly. Who progresses and who falls to the lower parts of the bracket. And so of these 400 teams over 9 rounds, you eventually get a ranking at the end of those 9 rounds, literally from first to last. So there's the first place team, second, third, and all the way through to the 400th placed team.
Wow.
Based upon those 9 rounds of preliminary competition. In order to make it to the second phase of competition, which is the elimination phase, you have to be in the top 32 teams. And so this last year in the Philippines, one of our teams was 22nd out of those 400 teams, and that was Colin Howie and Brett Frazier. So over the course of those 9 rounds, they assembled a record that was strong enough to place them in the top, well, in this case, top 5% of all teams in the preliminary phase. So they were in the first round of the elimination phase.
So I would think that there'd be a lot of pressure and a lot of stress in being in that position and going into the finals.
It's a lot of pressure, yeah. It's a lot of stress. You hope that you're against the right team, and we'll talk about what the right team means in just a second. You hope that you get a topic that you're familiar with and able to argue compellingly on. You hope you're on the right side of that. You hope you get judges that appreciate your style and understand your strategies. And so, yeah, there's a lot of stress and worry, but that's what it is, right? That's what it's all about. And so making it to that level of competition is what we're really striving for.
How many people in the audience for these last elimination?
In the elimination rounds, you'll have upwards of 200 or 300 people in the early elimination rounds. And then, of course, for the final round, everybody assembles to watch the final round. So you'll have the entire tournament assembled there of 1,200 people and another 500 or 600 members of the public who've gathered to watch as well. So it's a pretty sizable audience.
Now, we're talking about as you, parliamentary debate. It's not. It's a debate which is, in some sense, extemporaneous. You've just been given the topic not that long before.
Yeah, usually 15 or 20 minutes before the round.
So there's a sort of it's a fencing duel between the two teams. Yes.
Very much so. Yeah, very much so. We do a great deal of preparation to stay abreast of current events and contemporaneous topics. They are the research files that we assemble, which is what I believe is the key to our success, are pretty extensive. So everything that is in the news, everything that's controversial, everything that is getting attention, and lots of things that aren't in the news and aren't getting enough attention are things that we try and be pretty informed about so that we try and minimize the surprise factor.
You said that getting up against the right team. What does that mean?
Well, it means a couple of things. It means a team that's going to do well enough in the round that they don't mess things up. Debating is a very subjective activity, and you want to make sure that you're against a team that is good enough that your arguments look good against theirs. The worst situation to be in is to be a powerful team against a weak team, because that powerful team's arguments quite often will get confused or muddled or obscured by the weaker team's arguments.
So, explain, I don't quite get what you're saying.
Well, it has to do with the judge being able to sort through effectively the intersections between the arguments. That's what judges are always looking for, the points of clash where the arguments intersect. And so if both teams are good, solid teams and they see the round clearly, structure their arguments clearly, and make their arguments interact with yours, it's very easy for the judge to identify those points of intersection. Then all you have to worry about is making better arguments. But if you're against a weaker team, then you have to worry not only about making the better arguments, but also carrying the other team's arguments in such a way that you can demonstrate to the judge where your arguments interact with theirs and how they beat them.
So you got to figure out what their argument is.
Exactly. I mean, that's a much simpler way of putting it. Yeah, you have to figure out what they're saying before you can argue against it. And the more obscure or the more abstract or the less clear their arguments, the more likely it is the judge is going to misunderstand or misconstrue them and perhaps not in your favor.
Wow, I never would have thought of that. Mm-hmm. So you want them to be strong, but not
always
too strong.
Always want a good team. Always better to debate a good team than a bad team.
Interesting.
You're always more likely to win debating a good team.
Is that part of your practice, making sure that your sparring partners are equally matched?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think our practice is, I mean, by virtue of the fact that we practice a lot and that we have very, very seasoned, have had very seasoned competitors and very good competitors, our practice rounds, I think, are in many cases far better than a lot of the preliminary rounds that we're working on. But we also have a lot of practices where we deliberately sabotage rounds so that debaters learn how to work with those rounds too. And so I'll coach a team against whom we're sparring, another one of our teams, to do this certain thing that they know to be wrong, but I want to see how the other team's going to react to it so we can talk about strategies for dealing with those sorts of things.
So when you say do something that they know to be wrong, you mean say something that's not clear? Or
sure, yeah. Deliberately obscure an argument, misinterpret a term in the motion, run a case that is confusing and not clear and not well supported, and sometimes factually misstate factual evidence, those sorts of things. Mm-hmm. And all of that needs to be dealt with in competition because it happens in competition.
Now you're using some terms that I know a lot of people aren't going to know what they are. Oh. Motion, case.
Sorry. The motion is the topic for
today. Why don't you explain that sort of from beginning to end, how
sure.
a round goes?
Sure. So in the world's format of debate, there are four teams debating against each other, usually from four different universities. Those four teams are, two are on the proposition, who argue in favor of a motion, and two are on the opposition, who argue against a motion.
And a motion
the motion is the topic for debate, and so it's usually stated as a declarative, something like, this House supports hate crime legislation as an additional punishment for crimes motivated by bias. Mm-hmm. So whether or not we should punish those crimes with more sanction than we would other similar crimes is a topic for debate. Mm-hmm. And so you'll have two teams that are on the proposing side of that arguing that we should do so, and two teams that are on the opposing side arguing that we shouldn't do that. So each of those teams goes in. The first two teams are responsible for introducing the terms of the debate, laying out the foundational arguments, and building, kind of, we call it dotting the I's and crossing the T's of the debate, kind of building the foundation for the arguments. The second two teams are then responsible for integrating usually more broad arguments, perhaps more values-based arguments than pragmatic or policy arguments in the first half of the round, and then summarizing the positions of each of the teams on both of those sides. And so at the end of the debate, then after each team has had a chance to argue their position, the panel of judges, usually three, sometimes as many as 9 or 11 judges, will discuss the round, retire and discuss the round amongst themselves, and attempt to come to consensus about which team should be ranked first, second, third, and fourth.
And they are trying to separate their views about the motion from and what they think is sort of the right answer from who made the best argument.
Right.
What does it mean to make the best argument? If you're arguing a point of view that you disagree with, what makes that argument stronger?
Well, fundamentally, an argument is convincing. And so if the argument is compelling, if the argument addresses legitimate concerns of the opposition and counters those concerns in a persuasive way and ultimately presents good reasons for accepting the position you've been assigned or the position that you're advocating, that's a good argument. And so that's a very broad definition, but there are so many ways to persuade, there are so many ways that human beings change their mind that it's difficult to say what is a good argument. And I can tell you, you know, what is a particular technique for factual argumentation versus a particular technique for values-based argumentation, and there are a host of different tools available to you, but good persuasion is that which persuades.
But you can't. But you have to use. If you use rhetorical techniques, which are invalid, you know, an ad hominem attack, where you attack a person instead of their argument, then that would be marked off. People would say, "Well, that's yes or no."
You would certainly, but it's not as if there's a checklist, right? And I mean, it's not. You can't imagine parallels to like figure skating, where there are a certain number of precise skills that are being measured, and whether or not the athlete has mastered those skills. So it's not like a checklist and a certain number of points given or taken away for each particular skill that they're evincing. It's much more holistic and much more subjective, but at the same time, I think it's much more reflective of how we really think and how we really come to conclusions and make arguments about things. So I guess if you're looking for a broadly stated criteria for success, it is what is perceived to be credible. Right? And there are lots of things that can compromise your credibility, everything from the presentation of your message to the evidence that you use to support your arguments to the logical fallacies that you might fall into when trying to construct a compelling argument. All of those things can compromise your credibility or the credibility of your message. So at the end of the day, I mean, almost the first thing that I use to organize my discussion, because at the end of the round, I should say this too, at the end of the round, the judges are expected not only to reveal their decision, but to justify their decision to the debaters, to explain to them the reason for the rank.
Oh.
It's called the oral adjudication.
Mm-hmm.
And almost always I find myself coming back to this notion of credibility. So here's why this argument for me wasn't credible. Here are the mistakes that you made. Or conversely, here's why this argument was credible, why I found it persuasive, why I found it compelling, because it did these certain things and I found that compelling.
Mm. It seems like a wonderful tool for developing a young person or a mature person in being a good thinker or a person who's able to think clearly and have those thinking rules or heuristics in their mind that will give them good judgment.
Absolutely.
True?
Absolutely. And there are lots of those tools that we use. I mean, lots of strategies, lots of kind of time-tested and very useful structures of thought that we use. One is just a very simple analytical tool that we use when considering policy motions, those things that have to do with whether or not we should enact certain types of public policy. And that's breaking the broad topic down into four smaller topics called the stock issues model of analysis. And so you consider problem broadly and solution broadly, but within problem you consider whether or not the problem actually exists. Does it manifest itself as someone being affected and to what extent? And then you consider whether or not, or what has contributed to that, what causes that problem. And so disagreements about whether or not the problem exists or is significant, disagreements about whether or not there is an identifiable cause for that problem are areas that the teams might clash.
Mm-hmm.
Under the solution portion of the debate, you might debate first about, or you do argue first about, whether or not the proposed solution will actually solve the problem. And then also about whether or not the benefits of solving the problem will outweigh the costs of doing so.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are those sorts of structures of thought that you can teach people that very quickly allow them to take almost any issue, in this case, any policy issue, and break it down into its constituent parts and have them better understand where their arguments are intersecting with others and, if they're advocates, what makes for a compelling argument, or if they're opposing some issue of policy, how they can critique another's proposal.
It's one-on-one. My name is Charles Woolforth. I'm here with Professor Steve Johnson, who's the Director of Debate at University of Alaska Anchorage. UAA's debate team is phenomenally successful on a worldwide scale, ranked number 9, only one U.S. university, Yale, ahead of UAA. And I'm really interested in learning how you did this. And it strikes me, you know, we were just talking about that a big part of this is teaching or helping young people, the people on your team, learn to think clearly. What could be more important than that, right, in society as a whole? I mean, that's really what the university is all about.
Absolutely.
And you have shown yourself, apparently, to have some skills in that area that are well above what's happening elsewhere. And I know you've written a book on the subject. I guess I want to say, what's your secret? But I mean, do you think that there's, how do you get kids or anyone to learn to think in a logical, clear, rational way that can, and make persuasive arguments?
Well, I guess the easy answer is I'm obsessed with it, right? I mean, it is a healthy obsession. There are lots of obsessions you can have, I suppose. This is one of the more healthy ones. There's a certain joy that comes with clarity of thought, right? A certain satisfaction and a certain comfort and a certain security that comes with having the ability to think clearly about something. It brings a level of certainty to an otherwise uncertain existence, I guess is the way I would explain it. And so I always, when I first encountered debating and learned to think clearly, I found it to be so satisfying to be able to think clearly. And that eventually became the intellectual foundation for my entire life, that ability to think through things clearly, to see the structures of argument, to see what other people were doing and how they were attempting to persuade me, of what they were attempting to persuade me, and the failures that they made in their attempts to persuade me. And so there's a security in being able to do that because you see things more clearly. But it's not all about, you know, freedom from fear. It's also that joy of it as well. And I think that in anything that anybody does well, they do it because it's very personally rewarding for them. And this just happens to be what, for me, is very rewarding. You know, for Keegan Randall, it's skiing.
Right.
For me, it's debating. But whatever it is, it's the ability to just lose yourself in that moment, to lose yourself in that effort. And then, I think, where the other place that I excel as a coach is being able to share that with people, being able to explain that and to show that and to have other people feel that as well. And I still haven't lost that. I joke, but it's true, that there are very few things I would rather do than watch a good debate round. And it just, it's such a fulfilling process to be able to do that. And so to get other people excited about that, to share in that joy of finding that clarity of thought, to see that, at that level, to see real thinking in real time is a wonderful thing.
Yeah.
And that's something I think students respond to. I think anybody responds to that well.
I think that this idea of clarity of thought and learning to be a good thinker, i.e. someone who makes good decisions and can see things, it's obvious how that could aid you in your professional life. How has it affected your personal life and the way you go through the world at all? Do you think that you are able to deal with sort of the everyday decisions you need to make better because of that?
Oh, sure. You know, I won't say that I'm free from poor decision-making. Nobody is. But at least I'm much more able to diagnose when I've made a poor decision and why I've made it. In my personal life, I married another debate coach, and so we tend to think very similarly and have really good discussions about things.
I'd be interested if you were around one of your marital fights, right?
Yeah, they're not that much different. We just know what's going on more than other people probably do. It's not that we fight less, we just fight differently.
You could really irritate your spouse if you point out her rhetorical errors. Yeah,
I suppose so. But yeah, I mean, it's a very valuable thing professionally. It's in a very rewarding thing personally as well.
How do you identify talent in a young person who you're thinking about getting on your team? I mean, do you see, is it sort of, can you see the diamond in the rough, or sort of get them into it and start teaching them and then see them develop?
Absolutely, the diamond in the rough is the approach that I tend to gravitate toward. And I'm very proud of the fact that this student's with whom we've had the most success over the years, and particularly over these last couple of years, these are Alaskan students. You know, I'm not importing students from the lower 48 or from elsewhere to come and debate under UAA's flag. These are our students. They come from our Anchorage and Alaskan high schools, and they come to UAA in some cases to debate. In other cases, we pulled them out of the general student population. They were just there waiting to be found. And so what do I look for in a student? A degree of confidence. And then there is, you know, I'd be lying if I didn't say that there was some, there was a certain X factor there. There's a charisma, there's a personability to students, there's something that is different from them that draws people toward them, and I've got a pretty good eye for spotting that, and refining that and encouraging that.
I guess they've got to be quick on their feet.
Certainly, yeah, and they, you know, they tend to be the students who are quick, smart, witty, and willing to get into scuffles with people.
Yeah. Well, you've talked a lot about the clarity of thought and being able to organize your ideas. Mm-hmm. Is there just the having the gift of the gab, and can you win a few points in the debate just because you speak well and you know how to put the English language together?
Well, sure. I mean, it's a linguistic activity. I mean, it's about words, and so you want students who have some competence in that area. But I wouldn't say that's the first thing I look for. You know, I would say much more, I look for students that have that charisma, that have that personality, and that think well. And they don't have to be particularly verbal, because there's, you know, for all the talking that happens in a debate, it's only 7 minutes. Each student gets only 7 minutes to make their case. And so it's not, you don't need someone who is constantly talking. You need someone who is judicious in selecting what they want to say and when they want to say it. And so I wouldn't say that I'm looking for chatty students. I'm looking for smart students who know when to talk and when not to.
You must find it irritating to watch some of our political debates where people get up and they really just bloviate and often just don't address the question or just, you know, that there's very little that happens in our public life that really is very close to what you're talking about, eh?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say it's frustrating to watch them. You know, I guess it's no more frustrating for me to watch a political debate than it might be for Usain Bolt to watch a bunch of third graders in a three-legged race. You know, I mean, it's not the same thing. You know, we're doing two different things. And so as long as you don't call it a debate, mm-hmm. I'm okay with it. And I don't personally call those things debates. They're not. Everybody else does, but they're, in terms of comparisons to academic debate, they're not what we do. Am I frustrated? Could we do it better? Absolutely. You know, certainly political discourse could be improved. But that's long been a lament of the political process. Mm-hmm. It's not unique to our generation.
We focus in our society on sports competition, mm-hmm. Especially in universities. And we certainly have never had a sports team that has come close to what you're accomplishing in debate. I guess we've had some world-class cross-country skiers. Do you get all the resources you need, and do you wish that your debaters got the kind of attention that they would get if they were in a different kind of team?
Well, do we get the resources? Yeah, the university does a great job of taking care of us. We can always do more, and we're always looking for additional support. We've really begun to emphasize drawing upon our community and asking our community for support. We did a terrific event just recently with the Stanford debate team that came up.
And that was standing remotely, right?
We packed the house. It was amazing. And so I think our community is learning more about us and responding well to us. Mm-hmm. But I think the university very much values us. You know, I'm very proud of the university, and I think they're very proud of us. It's been a very positive and reciprocal relationship. Do I wish that generally people paid more attention to debate? Sure. But I don't think you'll ask any coach who wouldn't give that same answer, right? I mean, I wish people took as seriously as I do what it is we do.
Yeah. The kids, I guess, aren't doing it for glory.
Well, certainly not doing it for glory in the sense that they're going to be recognized walking down the street, but there's a certain amount of sense of accomplishment and recognition that goes on within our circles, for sure. And you're interacting with people who are some pretty outstanding individuals. You know, the top speaker at Worlds 2 years ago was the son of Lee Kuan, or grandson of Lee Kuan Yew, who was the Prime Minister of Singapore, who essentially made Singapore into the Asian phenomenon it is. And that's his grandson who's eventually going to be in line there probably for a significant political position at that point. And that's just one story among dozens of people with whom we interact that are the future generation of leaders in the world. Mm-hmm. So are they getting recognized by the general public? Maybe, maybe not. Are they getting recognized by people who are ultimately going to be in positions of power? Absolutely.
Where do you, where have you seen your students go after they leave you? This surely, if you're on one of the best debate teams in the world, you can write your own ticket academically. Yes?
It certainly helps. There's a increasing recognition of the importance, I think, of extracurricular activities beyond just the routine academic progress that people make. And I don't mean to say routine, but academic,
traditional
academic opportunities are things that all students have an opportunity to undertake. Going above and beyond that, I think, is what really distinguishes a student. And so if you demonstrate that you can concentrate in an area and really excel in it, I think you've made a name for yourself. Our students have gone on to do some amazing things. We have a number of students who are involved in pretty high levels of corporations. We've got one that is currently the chief information officer for a pretty successful startup down in the Bay Area. We've got one that is a very successful trader for Wells Fargo. We've got another student of ours who is the Senate liaison in the State Department. And we've got a couple that have just come out. Well, one that just graduated Harvard Law, one that graduated a couple years ago from the Kennedy School of Public Policy at Harvard. Our most recent success story is, like I mentioned, Brett Fraser. He's our UA's most recent Truman Scholar. And so we've got some pretty academically successful students.
It's a great impact. Yeah. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
I went by quickly. I've been talking with Steve Johnson, professor at University of Alaska Anchorage and director of debate there. Join us again next week for One-on-One.
One-on-One is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated. John LaFournaise directs and edits the show. Pat Yak is the producer. Camera operators are Travis Gilmore and Josh Edge. One-on-One was filmed at Kaladi Brothers Cafe at JL Tower in Anchorage. You can watch One-on-One Sunday nights at 6:30 p.m. and Wednesday nights at 10 p.m. on Alaska Public Television, or listen Thursdays at 1 p.m. on KSKA. Tune in next week for One-on-One when Charles Woolforth interviews West High School dance teacher Lori Bradford. This is KSKA Anchorage, FM 91.1.